Tell us the story of your victimization.
Well, my father was a Czechoslovak diplomat who had been based in London during the war, before the war, and came back after the war. And I continued my studies in Czechoslovakia until 1952, when I matriculated. And I was not allowed to study law because I was of bourgeois origin, my father having been a lawyer as well. My father had lost his job, and to make things worse, I had also been brought up in England, so that all these things compounded made me a class enemy. And I was just not allowed to study, and I had to go and work manually, because that was one way of cleansing my crimes of being a bourgeois, of being of bourgeois origin. I worked in a factory. I worked building a bridge, and I did various menial jobs. And with me were people who had been graduate lawyers, shopkeepers, judges, chemists, you name them. They were all sort of people who had the same kind of sort of menial jobs as I did. And we all worked sort of earning our living in that way. There were certain categories later when there were further purges, where they had actually sort of stratified people according to where they were allowed to work. There were five categories, the top being the top party people and screen members who were allowed to work in ministries and central offices. And it went down to people who could only hold manual jobs in factories. And then there were those who were not allowed to work in Prague or any of the big cities and had to work in either the steel mills or coal mining. And I was put into that category at that time.
Could you tell us something about this grading system? I mean, were they publicly made clear to you belonged to grade four?
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't made absolutely public, but it was known. I mean, these grades were more or less. It was a sort of a semi-official secret, but everybody knew, and it sort of seeped through that after these purges, somebody who had worked in a ministry, for instance, had to work in a factory, in an administrative job in the factory, but still only in a factory, whereas people who before that had maybe worked in a factory could move up to a ministry or even to I don't know, the Central Committee or something like that.
Could you give us two examples of some of the distortions created by central planning?
Yes, you had cases, for instance, where everything was planned, factories had to fulfill their plan and fulfill their quota, but of course there weren't parts, or there weren't enough parts to go around, so that usually the case was that one would spend the first fortnight doing nothing, or practically nothing, and then the next fortnight, when the spare parts and all the parts that were necessary arrived, we would be doing 16, 24-hour shifts in order to fulfill the plan, because we were paid piecework, which meant that we had to produce anyway in order to earn a living. And at the same time, the management was paid a bonus according to the fulfillment of the plan, so that there was interest on both sides to do this. And then, for instance, when I worked in a steel mill outside Prague in Kladno, that was in 1959 to 61, there again, the steel mill was, or the administration was paid a bonus according to the fulfillment of the plan, and there they would include even rejects, which went into the gross tonnage, because the plan was fulfilled by gross tonnage, which meant that the steel mill had in fact fulfilled its plan on paper, but of course half of its production wasn't available anyway.
Could you tell us something about ideology and propaganda in the 50s? I'd like to know how it was transmitted on the factory floor level, what sort of things you were told, and how workers reacted to it.
Ideology was everywhere. It was in the papers, in the radio. There was no television at the time, but it wasn't so much a matter of sort of total ideology. It was more the atmosphere created by the ideology, where people would hear something or read something, know that it wasn't true, but they wouldn't dare say anything against it. The party members in the factories who were more or less under orders to push over the party line would sort of give us pat phrases and probably wouldn't even believe them themselves or partly believe them. Apart from that, on the factory floor itself, it wasn't so bad because people didn't have to act the part so much because they had nothing else to lose, because the thing was that, of course, in a socialist state where manual labour is supposed to be the basis of productivity, it has always been used as a punishment. So that once somebody was working with his hands, he had nothing else to lose. It was the people in the administration, in schools, they were the ones who had to sort of be afraid of losing their jobs, and they were the ones who would then at least parrot the party line.
Could you give us one example of something you were told that no one believed, part of the party ideology?
Yes, for instance, I mean, there was the great case of the monetary reform of 1953, where there was a panic because the party bosses or the people inside the party knew there was going to be a reform, and they, in fact, started a buying spree, which then spread because everybody then began to know about it. At the same time, you had the party bosses in the factory, or the factory managers would call meetings and assure the workers that there was not going to be a monetary reform, that everything was fine. But people, A, didn't believe them, that they went on buying. Secondly, about a month later, it happened. So that there was that was one of the total sort of emptinesses of phrases.
What was the effect on people's savings of the reform?
The effect there was that people practically lost everything. Up to a certain amount, which was very small, you got 1 to 5. Above that, it was a rate of 1 to 50, old crowns for new crowns. And, of course, a lot of people who had maybe saved a lot of money before that were afraid of taking all their money to be changed because they would be asked questions of where they'd got the money before, so that many people lost everything.
What kind of people joined the party in the 50s, and was it a different kind of people in the 60s?
I would essentially say that the people who joined the party in the late 40s were still people who, a lot of them, had joined it from idealism, because they thought that there was something that could be done. The people who joined the party after, let's say, 49, were the ones who joined because they wanted to keep their jobs or they wanted to get promotion. But both sides, in fact, were still could still somehow talk together, even though there was a slight split. But they were all on one boat and they were all part of the elite, so that they all worked together. And essentially, after 68. Let's say the most vocal part of the party was expelled or lost their party membership. But again, those who stayed were more or less, again, the same. Those who stayed for more careerist reasons, rather, or there was more careerism in those who stayed after 68 than there was in those during the 50s.
Could you tell us about the grading system?
The grading system, and this was in 1958 when there was a second line of purges, was that because a lot of people had sort of managed to get back into reasonable jobs in administration, and there was this new purge, according to which people were again graded according to their backgrounds and according to what they'd been before 1948. And these grades suddenly ran unofficially. It was never sort of officially published, but they were grades of 1 to 5, where grade 1 was that you were passed for working in central offices and central administration. Grade 2, that you were allowed to work in second level jobs. Grade 3 was still administration. Grade 4 already meant that you would have to be passed from an administrative job into a manual job. And the fifth grade were people who would not be allowed to work in the Prague, for instance, or large cities, but had to work either in the steel mills or in the coal mines.
What was your feeling when Stalin died?
When Stalin died, it was really sort of, nobody really, I don't think, cared. It was there was maybe a sense of relief that maybe things were going to change, but in fact, Gottwald died a week later, and for the majority of the people, it didn't make much difference. Mind you, the party members, many of them, took it very, very badly. I mean, I saw when people announced, when it was announced that Stalin had died, I saw even young party members sort of bursting into tears, because for them, he was still the god. But for the rest of us, I mean, we sort of had more or less a sigh of relief, even though we didn't know what was going to come after it.
Was the flowering of democracy in the party and in society in 68 to 69, was that a surprise to the Czechs, most Czechs?
The Prague Spring itself, I think, was. Things had loosened up in the late 50s, early 60s. Things were becoming a little looser. More life was a bit easier. There was more in the shops available. There was more to read. Films were getting better. But the control of the society was still very, very tight, and you were more or less sort of checked on every step. 68 itself, when Dubček came to power, everybody said, well, so what? I mean, it was just one apparatchik for another. There was maybe a relief that Novotny had gone, but nobody knew who Dubček was anyway. And it was only gradually, because he came in with the same pat phrases that Gottwald had had about democracy. So, I mean, everybody had heard those before. But it was only then that suddenly people started realizing that by reading the papers, that maybe they actually meant what they were saying, so that the reception began to sort of snowball, and people actually sort of thought, okay, right, maybe they really mean what they're saying.
Did you, non-party people, did you think that the Communist Party might really be becoming genuinely a democratic party? Were you even tempted to join?
In the mid 1968, yes, there was a definite sort of converging of opinion. The party itself had become less, for one thing, less closed. Secondly, it had become more democratic, and there was even a feeling I myself almost joined the party, because it suddenly seemed that my point of view and its point of view had somewhere converged.
Was the Soviet invasion a shock to you?
The Russian invasion was a tremendous shock. It was almost unbelievable. I remember I was asleep on the morning of the 21st of August, and I was woken up by planes landing in 1 minute intervals at the airport just outside Prague. And I remember getting up and not knowing what had happened, and then I lived just above the radio station. I got out in the morning and I saw truckloads of Russian troops with red berets, fully armed, coming down towards the radio station, and being blocked off by a bus driver who'd swerved and stopped them just at the crossroads. And it was an unreal feeling. Nobody actually could really believe that the Russians had come, and also there was no reason for them to come. At least that was our opinion.
What did people feel like after it was clear the Prague Spring was destroyed by 1970? What was the feeling of those Czechs?
I think most people, at least friends of mine, and I myself more or less realized that it was over on the 21st of August, because it was obvious that it was going to stop. And it was also obvious that because the whole mechanism for the so-called normalization had in fact existed since 1948 for most people, or I would say for 80-85% of the people who had been second-class citizens for 20 years, after a brief breathing space of being sort of equal citizens. It was for them just going back to being second-class citizens. It was much harder for the party elite, who suddenly dropped from first-class citizens to second-class citizens, and suddenly, in fact, had to live the way everybody else had lived. But for most of the people, it was just going back to where things had been in 1967. 1969 was, in fact, there was no difference.
Could you tell us about the example of a communist lie, the devaluation story?
Yes, before the devaluation in 1953, the party people had been informed that there would be a devaluation, and of course they began going on to buying sprees, and this spread to everybody else, and there was a real buying panic. And in factories and on the radio and the media, people were assured that there would be no monetary reform, there would be no devaluation, that the currency was perfectly safe. And then suddenly it came, and people lost, many of them lost absolutely everything, because there was an exchange rate of 1 to 5, 1 new crown for 5 old crowns, up to the first 300 crowns, and then it came down to 1 to 50 for everything else. And there were people who, in fact, maybe had several thousand crowns who were afraid of bringing them, because they were afraid that there would be questions asked where they'd managed to amass so much money.
Thank you very much.